Welcome to episode 8 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse in which four friends slash Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 to 3 before the season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Let's go around and introduce ourselves before we launch into the discussion of episodes 5 and 6 of the second season.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Katie Burt.
And I'm Warren Fry.
And we are missing Chip Sutterth this week, sadly. The first week he's missed.
Very emotional.
Very emotional. Jen and I were saying that we're sad, especially sad he's not here because, you know, this is the episode that wraps up the Miller storyline in, you know, most ways. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a very important, it's also the end of the first book. So there's a lot of storylines that are coming to a close in some way. So I'm really excited to discuss these episodes. What did you guys think generally of these two episodes?
I thought they were great. Especially the first of the two. Yeah. But the second is a good table setting for the next sort of series, I guess.
Yeah, it's wild that these are what, like, episode 5 and 6 of the season. Mm-hmm. It feels like so much happens. It feels like they should be not, like, somewhere in the end or the beginning of a season.
Yeah, they're the end of season 1, even though season 1's ended. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And even, like, especially with Home, the first episode we're discussing, so many of the storylines are come together in this episode. So it's also, you know, we've watched so many episodes of things that are related to each other, and there might be some overlap between characters or settings, but so much of the story is, like, efficiently together in this episode, and it really changes the experience of watching the show, and I think just makes everything move even faster in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So before we jump into our spoiler-free discussion, we're going to give some brief synopses of what happened in these two episodes.
All right, so first we have Home, which aired on February 22nd, 2017. What happened to the Naboo? Doesn't matter right now. We have to stay on Proto Eros, which has decided to start speeding towards Earth at stroke-inducing speeds. Earth is understandably freaked out about this turn of events and decides to launch half of its nuclear arsenal in an attempt to prevent a collision that would cause billions of casualties. Proto Earth doesn't break a sweat, going radar dark and making it impossible for Earth's missiles to lock onto their target. Lucky for them, Holden is always in the right place at the right time, or the wrong place at the wrong time. The Rossi crew agrees to keep pace with Proto Eros, even if it kills them, so they can paint a target for the missiles, and Fred Johnson kindly agrees to take navigational control of the missiles to guide them in. Meanwhile, Miller is slowly making his way to the heart of Eros, malfunctioning bomb in tow. Naomi is guiding him in, hoping that Miller will somehow be able to plant the bomb, get scooped up by the Rossi, and destroy Proto Eros in the process. But Miller sees the writing on the wall, and hears the voice of Proto Julie. This was always where he was going to end up. Finally, Miller finds Proto Julie right where he left her, in her room in the Blue Falcon. She's done some redecorating since we last saw her. The hotel is now an ethereal world of blue protomolecule. Firefly-like protomolecules floating through the air. Julie is at its center. Miller realizes that Julie is staring Eros. She thinks she's on her racing ship going back home to Earth. She doesn't realize she's a space station that could cause billions of deaths. Miller wakes Julie up and tells her she's not alone. They crash into Venus on Eros together.
All right, Godspeed aired on March 1st, 2017. The UN Council, Security Council, still has no idea what the frack just happened with Eros. Was it Mars testing a new fuel drive? Shrug! They decide to send a ship to check out the crash site on Eros. A scientist named Michael Iturbe wines and dines Chris Jen so he can get a spot on the expedition, as if that wasn't Chris Jen's plan all along. Chris Jen confronts Aaron Wright all about Mao, asking him to pass a message on to his corporate frenemy, and unless Mao tells the government everything he knows about what the frack is going on, she will make living an absolute hell for anyone with the last name Mao. Meanwhile, 30 of Earth's deployed nuclear missiles have been misplaced. Oh, never mind. Nothing to worry about. Fred Johnson and drummer found him. Oh, and would Naomi help them get past security measures so the OPA can have full control over a mini-nuclear arsenal? Naomi agrees to help her Belgic compatriots, and when the Rossi decides to destroy the proto-molecule sample they left floating in space, Naomi tricks Holden into believing she sent a torpedo to take it out. I'm sure that decision won't come back to haunt her later. Meanwhile, during what was supposed to be a boring mission on Farm Station Ganymede, Bobby is caught in the middle of a chaotic battle. While it's unclear how it all started, both Martian and Earther forces are involved. With her squadron lying dead around her, a groggy Bobby looks up to the face of another player in the battle, an intelligent alien creature. Oh yeah, and there's this dude named Epstein who invented the Epstein Drive and accidentally killed himself in the process. This place takes place 137 years before the events of The Expanse.
A lot happens in those episodes.
Yes, quite a bit.
But they also managed to, like, they never feel overpacked, and they managed to have this little, like, Epstein vignette in one of them as well. We talked a little bit in the, before we were doing the synopses, about this being, you know, the end of the first book, and then the second episode being the start of the second book.
Mm-hmm.
But I am curious how, yeah, I guess more specifically how you both feel about having that come in the middle of a series, both in during this rewatch, and maybe if you can remember back to the first time you watched it, if that felt strange at all, or if you even noticed when you were watching.
You mean the vignette thing, or?
I was talking specifically about having all these storylines wrap up midway through the second season versus, like, adapting a book per season, which tends to be, you know, with these TV adaptions, what happens. For understandable reasons. And I think it's really interesting that they chose to do it a little differently. And I wonder how things like, you know, bringing Christian in earlier, bringing Bobby in earlier, having this Epstein, which was originally a short story, like mini story within an episode, how all those narrative decisions affect that pacing.
I think it works, honestly. I think it would work better than cramming everything into the first season. Especially with what they have, like 10 episodes, ten for all of them, I think. I don't think it works to cram all that stuff. I mean, it seems pretty fast-paced to begin with, doesn't it?
Yeah, it never, I think it totally, it didn't seem to me when I watched it, if I remember, that it was, oh, this weird break.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just want to, I mean, especially they have this cliffhanger with Bobby. Like, having her introduced early on, I think it really helps kind of, you have these characters that if they had just been randomly introduced now, I think it would have made it feel like a weirder break. But because you brought them in earlier.
The only thing that does, go ahead.
No.
The only thing that does feel weird to me is the vignettes. Like when they show this Epstein thing, it just seems to be kind of out of nowhere and it doesn't really seem to tie into anything. And previously with, what's his name? The guy we all hate, Diego, and his uncle out in space hauling rocks. When I first saw that, I had no idea what was going on and why they were devoting so much time to it. And I never really connected Diego to that. So for the longest time, I was very puzzled as to what this was for. Mm. And I felt that a little bit less with the Epstein drive. But those little vignettes that they throw in for flavor or to add something to it. I mean, they're interesting, but I don't think they're the things that make me feel it's disjointed, not all the other story that they're putting in a different position in the books.
I'm really curious what we were supposed to get from the Epstein vignette, because I do feel like that doesn't really feel like it fits here, especially when all these other storylines feel so connected.
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's so much about, like, oh, this is how we're able to do this travel. This is how the effects on the body of doing this type of space travel. And you kind of already picked up most of that just by watching the show.
Yeah, it seems like something from the book that they wanted to put in because it was from the book and didn't. I mean, it's interesting, but it's kind of a deleted scene interesting, you know what I mean? Like, whereas all the other stuff we're watching ties together.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. It doesn't really tie in tonally with where the rest of the episode is at or even where the show is at, because it is this, you know, it's like a very horrifying thing that we're seeing happen, but it's not really played off in that way. And I'm not really sure how I'm supposed to feel about it. And we don't know this person. This person isn't a character, really. So it doesn't, Yeah, it is confusing. And it's actually based on a short story isn't part of the books.
They do it in the third season, too. And I'm not going to say how until the spoiler thing. But there it ties in, and there's a beginning and an end to it. And that's, I think, what bugs me about this. There's no beginning, and what the rock hopping thing, there isn't either. There's no beginning end to it. It's just this sort of plot strand that doesn't go anywhere. He's still flying off to, I don't know, the Pluto or wherever by the end of it.
Yeah. You don't actually see, like, you know that he dies, or, like, you assume that he dies, but they don't actually, you know, show that or actually have anyone confirm it. And also, because so much of it is delivered in voiceover format, as if it's after the fact, it's also very jarring because you're like, is he, like, a ghost telling this from after, you know, he died? Like, it's very confusing to me. Why he's telling the story in that way.
Unless they're tying it in with the proto-molecule being another new way to navigate around. But they don't really follow up on that until the very end either. So.
Yeah, and they have that voiceover about like how technology changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
But that also feels strange because the proto-molecule is the thing that's changing everything, or one of the things that's changing everything here. And that's not a technology.
Or if it is, it's so far advanced that it doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So
I wonder, and I could look into this, but it almost feels like it was something that was created for marketing purposes or to try to, like, bring in a different audience and then, like, and I don't know if it was, like, released separately as, like, watch this little, like, short story from
World
of the Expanse.
Yeah.
It totally feels like a web exclusive or something.
Yeah, but it's in the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's
in
weird about
it. In a very important episode. Not that
that I otherwise love. And I kind of like this thing on its own. I just don't know what it's doing there.
Yeah, it feels like those Discovery web things. That
Short Trek?
Yes, yeah, it totally does. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But there's a lot of main plot.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to take us off the beaten track there.
Oh, no, I thought that was great. So, do we want to dive into the ending of the Miller storyline and him finding Julie again? Do
yeah,
we want to
totally.
Start off with that, or do we want to work up to it?
No, let's go for it.
Okay. So, I'm curious, you know, this feels particularly like the first episode is like particularly a Miller episode, although there are lots of people involved and there's lots of plots coming to a conclusion. What worked for you about this ending for Miller? If anything.
I mean, he seems to, well, for one thing, he reaches his ending, which is great. And Thomas Jane really delivers on that. And the whole thing of Eros just being taken over by all this goop was fascinating and beautiful. Like, it was beautifully shot. I'm trying to figure out how they did it. I'm guessing, and this is just me being a nerd, that everything but the Firefly stuff was practical. And then the Firefly little bits were added in CG. But everything else is the kind of thing where they just put tissue everywhere, spray whatever it is on it, and then turn the lights to blue, because that'd be a lot cheaper than doing it the other way. I'll tell you what didn't work for me is, and I know this kind of makes sense within the story, but having Julie there, like, quote-unquote naked, where I was like, oh, really, guys? Again, this is exactly what Marvel Comics in the 70s would do, you know? So that kind of bugged me. But then again, what's she going to be doing? Wearing clothes? Like, that doesn't make any sense either, so. Because she's, like, all molecule.
I wonder if there was a way to do that effect, though, of the proto-molecule that, I don't necessarily think it would have made sense to have proto-molecule clothes.
No.
But,
But, like, maybe more goop on her or something. But then it takes away from, then she becomes less human, which she is, but you know what I mean? Like, you can't relate to her visually as much. So it's kind of a tough one, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, one of the things that really works about Miller's ending is where he leaves his relationship with the Rossi crew. The thing he says right before he cuts off communication, you know, saying, like, thank you for letting me in your family. I thought that worked really well. And how when Holden makes that decision and they all just go along with it, that they're going to stick with Eros. And, of course, that is... No, they're not just doing that for Miller, because it's also important that they, you know, they also care about trying to save Earth. But it does feel like he is some kind of factor, and the fact that one of their, you know, family members is on that ship and they have some loose, terrible plan to save him.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that's an awful plan. Know. There's no way they're actually going to save him. It's just not going to happen.
There's no specifics. We're all just like, and then we'll just like go get him. And you're like, okay, whatever.
Part three profit. Sure, guys.
So that worked really well for me. And like just watching him drag his bomb across the station.
Oh, yeah.
Little wagon. I loved all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. When he finds the little cart, it's like, yes.
I actually just, this week as well, in addition to watching these two episodes, I watched the first three episodes of the show with my brother.
Okay.
Because he wants to start watching it. So it was really interesting to watch these episodes right after having watched the introductory episodes of Miller. And really to see how far he's come in a lot of ways. But also, you know, for me, disappointing in the ways that this obsession with Julie is never really the motivations of that and, like, potentially, like, problematic nature is never really explored in a way that makes me watch the scene and feel the things that I think the show wants me to feel in these moments. I remember feeling this so strongly the first time I watched it, too, where I just didn't understand. The scene didn't work for me of him and Julie coming together, mostly because I was still like, Julie doesn't know this person.
Yeah, I was the same.
Why would she kiss him? Like,
that's like meeting somebody who's like in an accident or something. And then they start kissing. Yeah. You're like, oh, what? No. Wrong response.
And he still calls her kid when he first meets her, which is still like, I don't know, weird to me. I remember feeling really like bummed out, I guess, the first time I watched this, that I wasn't feeling the things that I wanted to be feeling, because I do care about this character on some level, but this isn't why I care about him. And I never really grew to care about Julie enough to
care
about this ending.
And the music and visuals are telling you to, and you're like, well, no, music and visuals, you're wrong.
And Thomas Jane is acting, and I'm like, yes, I want to be there with you, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm. I really wonder if a few, like, slight changes to this final scene, like, you know, a few lines of dialogue that he has about her, and just kind of, like, sexualizing this relationship, and then, like, not kissing her. I think I would have been...
Just grab her arm or something, and then the protomolecule crawls up in his hand or something, you know what I mean? So it's more protomolecule and less two people hooking up, if that makes any sense.
Because it just feels like, regardless, putting aside the, like, she doesn't know this person, it's like, she's also on this level of, like, I can't feel my hand, like, how do you consent when you're, like, also kind of a proto-molecule in your...
On the other hand,
like,
what if the proto-molecule does know him? Like, you know what I mean? Maybe she knows him through the proto-molecule, or I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, but it's still... I still get the same reaction you do. I still got the same, something's a little off about this whole deal.
Yeah. And I was really curious to get to this scene, because I do think this time around, seeing Miller become part of the Rossi crew, I felt more invested in his character than I did the first time around. And then it gets to this, and I was like, nope, I still hate this.
I was nonplussed is the best way to put it. Even though it's a beautiful looking scene. Like, everything that's happening around
I wanna like it.
Well made.
Yeah, I wanna like there's parts of it I just it's so beautiful.
And I think you're both right in that there are a few small things they could have made just in how they play it out, and like, if they had embraced in like a different way, or he had just like, just the fact that they're two, I mean, she's not human anymore, but she is human, and like, they're two humans who, you know, both wanted so desperately to believe in a cause and in some way found it. And that is really beautiful. You know, when Naomi's talking later to Fred Johnson, and she's like, I want people to know the story of this Earther and this Belter who, you know, saved the planet, or saved Earth. And she does throw something in there about a love story. And I'm like, not you too, Naomi.
How did they get to you? How?
Yeah. But they're, yeah, I think if they had played it in a different way, I would have felt a lot more. And I also think you're right, Warren, and I was looking for this time as well, where there are these hints that, you know, there's something that the proto molecule maybe knew, had them know each other in some, like, yeah, like, not mystical way or spiritual way, but, like, we don't understand how the proto molecule works. So is there some way that it has connected these two people even before they actually met? But
she doesn't play it like that. She plays it like she's a victim, you know what I mean? So
she doesn't play it like that, and more importantly, the show doesn't play it like that. You can project your own meanings onto it, but if it's not, like, depicted in a way that you can actually... if it's not depicted, then it's not there, you know? Mm-hmm. That's something you have to, like, put onto it. You can't read it in the text. At least I don't think so. It's not there explicitly enough. And I was listening... I don't know if, Warren, you had a chance to listen to this. I sent a link to both of you, and I know Jen has listened to this. Yeah, that's okay. So I was listening to the Churn podcast, which was the sci-fi... I don't know if they're probably still not doing it now that the show's on Amazon, I'm assuming.
I would bet they aren't.
So they did a podcast for every episode, and I think Jen's listened to all the episodes.
But I don't remember this episode because I listened to it 2 years ago.
But they have, you know, collectively James S.A. Corey on the podcast to talk about the scene, and they're saying that they did have this idea of, you know, you see these flashes of, like, when Julie's in the Blue Falcon and she sees Miller come in, even though he's not there and she's never met him.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, a ripple of the protomolecule, like, going back in time. And there's also this, you know, we see the protomolecule form a sparrow, which is also, a theme that we've seen with Miller, where he saw a sparrow in the very first episode. And
right, yeah, yeah.
Wondering if it was that sparrow even there in, like, real life, or was that already, like, the protomolecule affecting him somehow? And I like that idea of, like, not totally knowing, but there's not enough there, in my opinion.
Yeah, that works better in a book, way better in a book than it does in a TV, which is, you know, there's different mediums, so.
I think they would need to have put more of that in if they wanted that.
Yeah.
To be communicated.
I mean, that's the problem with TV, is you kind of have to explain this stuff. Or you make Twin Peaks, one of the two. There's not a lot of middle ground.
It is impressive how there are moments where I'm like, I'm really glad they don't over-explain things. So it is hard because I don't want them to over-explain things. Mm-hmm. And they get through things a lot faster. But even in moments where when Naomi launches or pretends to launch the torpedo to take out the sample of protomolecule, they really don't spell that out for you. It's like on the screen, on her screen, on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it's just very subtly done. And I feel like if you weren't an eagle or just an engaged viewer, which I know a lot of people who aren't, who watch things very casually, and maybe you can't watch The Expanse if you're that kind of TV viewer.
No, but odds are you're on your phone, right? So yeah, you might miss it.
Yeah, you look away for that 30 seconds or 15 seconds and... But also, is it that easy to pretend there's no indication on the screen that is a simulation, other than when she engaged simulation, and then Holden's totally fooled by that?
Yeah, like, Holden's not that dumb.
Yeah, that seems a little...
I just had to point out, I really did like this episode, even though we're criticizing the hell out of it.
Oh, yeah, no, these are incredible episodes, yeah.
They're great. So just to go back to the Rossi, I know we've talked a lot about Naomi's decision, especially in the, like, spoilery section of previous episodes, because we knew this was coming, but it is interesting to get to see that conversation the Rossi crew finally has, where they all get to, you know, if they have an opinion, chip in about what they should do with the protomolecule. What was watching that scene like for all of you?
Oh, I liked it because they're going to have different opinions on what this thing is all about. And they're all from different parts of the solar system, right? So it totally made sense for them to have differing points of view, Mars and the belt and everything else.
I think it's interesting how quickly Alex goes from, like, we should give it to Mars, to, all right, let's destroy it. Like, he really does, you know, shift pretty quickly in that.
Destroy it, which, is the easy out, you know, though, really. When you know, it's if you get rid of it, then it's not a problem anymore.
Yeah.
It does seem like Holden has a strong opinion. Naomi has a strong opinion, but she's not actually revealing that she has a strong opinion. Mm-hmm. And then Alex and Amos are just kind of like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they've been through a lot. I think also thinking about these little meetings in the context of, like, all of the decisions they've had to make and all of the things. Like, their friend just crashed into Venus.
Mm-hmm.
there's a lot going on.
Which, isn't it the first time that Amos, like, sides with Holden against, like, not against Naomi, but against Naomi? Like, you see that, you know, that there's this whole conversation of him being like, there are three types of people: evil people, the people you follow, and the people you protect. And this seems like it's really the first time that he's like, Holden might be someone you follow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been slowly, but he's really moving from that, like, you're supposed to be the captain, but Naomi's really the captain.
I'm not sure I buy his philosophy in the first place, but yeah.
Oh, no. It doesn't, I mean, maybe
it seems pretty reductive, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting. It's like, there's no good people in his framework.
True. That I agree with.
There's evil people. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's evil, truly evil people either. It's hard to, this is,
we could spend a lot of time solving nothing by discussing this.
Yes, exactly.
What did you guys think about the little, like, or maybe not little, the argument that Amos and Alex get in, which is more of Alex getting angry at Amos. I don't think Amos ever thinks they're in an argument.
You know what totally reminded me of, and this is going to, did you guys ever read the Watchmen graphic novel?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know the part where Rorschach is telling Night Owl a bunch of facts about the guys that murdered his mentor, and Night Owl goes off on him and says, what the hell are you talking about? And he realizes, oh, this guy doesn't have any empathy. That's why he's trying to reassure me in the only way he can. That's what this reminded me of.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. So we also see Fred Johnson and drummer steal 30 missiles from Earth. They just kind of slip those away and catch them in a giant net.
So that's,
I'm sure.
So that's half of the Earth arsenal is 30 missiles when there's countless thousands now. Like, that seems a little ridiculous
to me. I think there was a line about them launching half of their arsenal. So not 30. It was like, I don't know, 100 and.
Okay. I mean.
They recover. Yeah. They like recover a portion of them.
Yeah. They recover most of them.
But
so,
I do think it's only like 300. Or something.
Yeah,
like that. I think
because
they like, which is still like, absurd.
I mean, you don't want proliferation of missiles, obviously, but we don't now. But didn't they nuke that ship that had Protomonaco on it? Like, am I wrong? How'd they get rid of it? Because if they did that, then you'd think anybody's got a nuke, you know, just kicking around, or ships do anyway.
Yeah,
that is a good question.
Yeah,
what are the levels of like weaponry?
Yeah,
like it's gonna, like, go.
The Rossi has,
It's gonna 102 ways. You got nukes have been, you know, sort of controlled enough that you can have smaller versions of them, or they've been depleting the number of nuclear missiles like we're trying to do now because it's a dumb idea to have nuclear missiles. But I wouldn't see it. I don't see a middle ground there, right? So.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that, you know, not to give too much, I don't think this is really giving anything away, but like for the OPA to have 30 missiles at their disposal, like, significantly changes
the
balance,
how much power they have, so that says something about the world. How do you guys feel about that decision of Fred Johnson and Drummer?
I mean, they'd be crazy
of the missiles.
Crazy not to, wouldn't they? Like,
I mean, I think the show just really sets up, you know, the Belters being the real, like, oppressed group that we're supposed to be rooting for, that I'm like, great!
Yeah. Good job, guys!
Yeah, they should definitely, you know, have more a balance of power. At least at this point, I feel that way. Mm-hmm. There's some, you know.
Do Do you think that was something they were considering as soon as they said, like, give us the codes or the access to the missiles? Do you think that was always part of their plan? Or because you don't get really get to see that from their point of view. You just see the message from the UN Security Council's point of view.
They don't have that much time to think about it.
But also, Fred Johnson's a pretty smart dude, so I don't want to shortchange him and say, oh, he came up with that after the fact. He might have come up with it before the fact because he is a crafty guy. So, I mean...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's like... These episodes really show how much of a, like, real strategist he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's...
And we also... These are great Christian episodes, as far as I can tell, all episodes that Christian is in are. but in some ways it does feel like, you know, this isn't as big of an ending for her as it is for Miller, but we do get to see somewhat like this, you know, staying in the background plan come mm-hmm. to fruition. Not only with her exercising power when these big decisions are being made, when Eros is coming towards Earth, but also in the scene where she... you know, just gets very angry at Aaron Wright, rightfully so, and it's kind of wonderful.
My favorite part of that whole thing is where she just kind of quietly sashays in, unleashes complete hellfire, and then quietly sashays out again. I was just like, oh my God, that's beautiful.
Yeah, her entrance is just like, oh, do you have a minute? Or something like that.
Yeah, it just completely takes you by surprise when she just nails him to the wall, and then I gotta go. Do-do-do-do-do-do.
I like to imagine she's going to another meeting that's going to be just as intense.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It's just crazy to me that I'm pretty sure she doesn't show up until after the Ganymede incident in the books. So, say as with Bobby, she wouldn't show up until...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
I'm happy with this.
This is... Like, I stopped reading. I read... half of the first book, and then once I started watching the show, I'm like, I don't need to read the books anymore. It's just gonna confuse me. I'll just go with this.
Yeah, that's how I feel too. I mean, who knows, maybe after I watch the TV show, or yeah, after I finish the TV show, I'll go back and read the books. I would mm-hmm. definitely be open to that. But I'm definitely someone who, if I really love a like on-screen adaptation of something and I haven't read the thing that it's being adapted from, I will choose not to, because I want to preserve the adaptation experience for myself. I think one of the biggest examples of this is I saw Lord of the Rings. I had already read The Hobbit when Lord of the Rings the movie came out, but I had never read The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And I waited until I had seen each of the movies until reading the... I read them. Like, I read the first book after I'd seen the first movie and read the second book after I saw the second movie, but before the third movie it came out. But yeah, I think there's something valuable in that. Or it's as valid a choice as choosing to, you know, read the book as well.
But with Lord of the Rings, I was so relieved that it looked like what I thought the book was going to look like. But also, I did the same thing as you. I read the first book before the first movie came out. Didn't bother with the second book. After Return of the King, I went back to Return of the King and read it, and I was like, does he say hello to every horse in the kingdom? Like, how long is this going to take? This is ridiculous. This is endless. Oh, it's breakfast. Yeah. 10, 20 pages later, I'm like, for God's sakes, Mary, I've had enough of this.
That's so true.
I did the same thing with Game of Thrones, where I had read the first three books before the show came out and then was kind of annoyed that I had read them when I started watching the show. So I was like, I'm purposefully not going to read anymore.
I found the books very helpful up to a point, because after I'd watched the first three or four seasons, I went back and read the books and I could finally put names to faces, because it just goes by you the first time. So like for the longest time, I called Drogo Muscles Horses, because that's his two things, muscles and horses. So I was like, that's how I'm going to remember this guy. That's old Muscle Horses. And then I'm reading, oh, there's actually a fully fleshed out dude. Okay, fine. Good. So I could kind of follow things when I watched it again. And then by the time we got to the last season, where once they sort of went off from where the books were to begin with, I just kind of gave up. And I also gave up halfway through the last book, because there's a good chunk of it that's just the politics of the people in the ocean, and I'm like, I don't care about the people in the ocean. They're barely in the show. Who cares? So yeah, so it can be fraught.
Well, maybe that will be a good episode of A Legitimate Salvage, or a few episodes, if after, you know, if there's a lull in the TV show, as there will be, we can go back and read some of the books and
see dropping,
how that experience is.
If they're dropping after all watching the 10 TV episodes at once, which I think they are, then, we've probably got about a month left of episode, of season four, and then, and then we got the books, basically. Yeah, you're right.
We go from a lot of content to zero new content. So the other big storyline in this episode, or in these episodes, is we finally get to check back in with Bobby. And we actually don't spend that much time with her.
Is Bobby only in the second episode of these? Or
yes.
Yeah.
But the time that we do spend with her is very impactful.
Mm-hmm.
And so well done, in my opinion. Just the chaos of the, I guess we can call it a battle. It's even knowing, and we can talk more about this in the spoiler section, but knowing more about what is actually happening, because you find out later, it's still a very chaotic battle scene. It works so well, especially for this person who has always thought that she wanted, this is exactly what she wanted, to face conflict, to face battle. Or to be in battle, and then to get there and have it be so horrifying, I think is really effective.
I thought the stuff with the drone was really effective too, because it really kind of catches you off guard, just like it does them. You're like, oh, that's nothing. It's just a drone. And of course it's not. It's Chekhov's drone. It's going to be something bad. But they kind of fool you anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And we do get our first look at this like proto-molecule man. And he is so frightening. I think I can, like, conjure up an image of this entity in my brain, like, so clearly when I'm not watching the show, because it's such an effective visual for me. Do you guys think he's scary?
He's, I mean, a glowing dude with evil eyes. He looks like a Micronaut. So, I mean, he's terrifying. Yeah.
There's something about those eyes. I don't know what it is. It's just really...
They ain't right. Really That's well. What it is.
Yeah.
And the way he moves. I think there's something very creepy about the way he moves to me.
But you don't even see that much of him
moving. No.
Like, there's only... So really all you're seeing is this, like, terrifying face.
He moves
He just leans in.
He moves so slowly until he doesn't. He's one of those, you know?
But she's always also lying there on Ganymede, and her like, faceplate is cracked, and she's unconscious and doesn't know what's going on, and then he leans in and you see it from her POV, and you're like, oh, what the hell.
Yeah, that shot of like, you can see the faceplate is cracked and you can see the like mirrors at,
that's amazing,
and the drone, and then the protomol, it's like, oh, what a, that's just so good.
I don't know how they do that. Like, they didn't have that big a budget, from what I can tell. So I do not know how they pull this off, because it looks fantastic.
Yeah. Oh.
I agree.
It's so good. I have nothing more to.
Okay. Does anyone have anything else to say before we move into the spoiler zone?
Nope. I think we covered it.
Nope. Yeah.
I did want to mention that I will be interviewing some of the cast and producers at New York Comic Con. So if anyone has any specific questions about season four or anything else, you should tweet at us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. That's LegitSalvage. Okay, we are now entering the spoiler zone. For those who haven't watched past episode 6 of season 2 and do not wish to be spoiled for the rest of season 2 and season 3, now is the time to shut off the podcast. We hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of season 2's The Seventh Man and Pyre. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found and follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. For everyone else, let's dive in. So we talked a little bit about this in the pre-spoiler section, but there was this mention on the Churn podcast where I can't remember if it was Ty or Daniel who says that the moment of Julian Miller's meeting was rippling out forward and backwards in time. And I was trying to think if there are any examples, if I could think of any examples of it rippling forward. I don't even know what that means necessarily, and I don't know if they have a clear idea of what it means. But we obviously do check back in with the Miller character, or the proto-Miller character, later on in the show.
The only thing I can think of is the whispers that are happening. So maybe there's stuff from later on that you'd only catch now if you've seen it already, but I didn't catch anything, so.
No.
Yeah, I will be curious to see, especially when Miller comes back, just kind of comparing that to what it was like when he was seeing Julie, when he was like the human seeing the proto-Julie, and what it's like when he's in that other position and it's Holden who's seeing him or communicating mm-hmm. with him, if there's any similarities, because it is a different situation.
Yeah, because at that point, the proto-molecule is like so much more advanced, or like, understands how to communicate with humanity a little bit better.
Yeah.
Like,
it also makes me wonder, like...
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, we see in Home that Julie is still, you know, the protomolecule, you know, infects her or whatever, but she infects the protomolecule as well, and she's the one who's, you know, wants to go back to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So just thinking about that in terms of the Miller we see later, you know, how much of that is Miller, how much of him is left there, and how much of it is just proto-molecule or even just Holden's, like, memories of who Miller was.
I thought it was all proto-molecule. Like, it was just the proto-molecule taking a familiar form. It's like an AI simulating somebody. In fact, that's what I kind of think the proto-molecule is. It's kind of like an AI, essentially. Well, that's what one aspect of it is anyway.
And I guess it's one of those things, too, of, like, is the proto-molecule in this episode really Julie's consciousness? Is it just, like, this is what Miller wants to see?
That's a good point.
I don't think that's what they're going for, but when you think about it in relation to Miller, because I agree, that's how I read
proto-Miller.
Proto-Miller is, like, just totally proto-molecule,
mm-hmm.
but not... But that's definitely not... I don't think that's what they intend with Julie, but...
Well, she's the first one they infect, right? I think.
Yeah.
But then why doesn't this happen with these...
Crystal.
Yeah, but then why doesn't this happen with all the other kids that they're infecting later on? You know, why aren't they becoming bigger parts of the whole? They just become monsters, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
Does the protomolecule get better at it? Is that what learning looks like?
Or is it that the humans are doing it in a specific way that sort of it goes a different direction?
Yeah, when the humans are kind of manipulating this.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Because the proto-molecule is doing it on its own, or Julie's affecting it, one of the two, or both, as opposed to evil scientists doing stuff to kids, which is more controlled, you'd think.
Yeah, but it's also one of those things of, like, okay, if Julie is able to control this on some level, but, then like, a child's consciousness. Yeah. What? Yeah.
And so we... You know, we mentioned meeting the proto-molecule man at the end of Paradigm Shift. And at this point, it feels like, you know, this is like the pinnacle of the proto-molecule. Or mm-hmm. that's what we're led to believe. But obviously, we see the proto-molecule evolve past that. Do we think the creators are sending us down like a back alley with these proto-creatures? Or... Is it that they can be anything?
It kind of changes into a monster show in a way, you know what I mean? Or a creature feature. And the proto-molecule is more than that, but for a long time, for season 2 and season 3, it isn't. It's this thing, right? Or people trying to make it into a thing. So, I don't know. And I enjoyed watching that part of it, but you kind of think less of the proto-molecule than you do later when it becomes a gateway to other planets.
Yeah. Like, will that ever come back again? Possibly.
But then the theme you
like
can pull
this
out
form,
of that
yeah.
is that, well, if humans aren't screwing around with it, it is something different. If we ruin it because we're humans.
Yeah. Because, I love the whole, all of the episodes were like, the proto-molecule man is, like, stuck on the Razi, for example. Like, that's just great space horror. Like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is.
I love that kind of stuff. But, it is a weird side shoot.
What are the rules of the proto-molecule?
Well, it's kind of a get out of jail free card, isn't it, really? I mean, like,
yeah,
it's kind of like dilithium crystals or something. Or there's probably a Star Trek equivalent I'm not thinking of. Or nanotech is used like this, too. Oh, it's nanotech. Oh, okay, then. Sure, I guess.
At this point, I trust the show enough and get the feeling from the show that they have rules even if they don't explain them to us. And I don't know how much longer if like that would work. But at this point, I'm still totally okay with how they've used the protomolecule. Even though I think this is a really good point, Warren, that... It isn't really clear why the protomolecule even manifests in this way, besides the fact that it does make a very cool visual and creepy storytelling tool.
But I bet you in season four they don't have any creatures running around. It's all different stuff. Or it's just the gateways and that's that. They have different stuff to deal with.
Yeah. So we also get to see, you know, the Eros crashes into Venus with Miller and Julie on board. And for a while, we really don't follow up on that. Like in these, in Paradigm Shift, we see the beginnings of a mission coming together. But I wonder, I was trying to remember like how quickly some of this storyline moves and how quickly we get back to Miller.
Yeah, is this the end of season two, I think, where these guys are on Venus or on quote-unquote Venus and then get disassembled?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like one of the ending visuals. It's so beautiful.
And they never actually explain what happens to those guys. I assume they just die or become part of the protomolecule.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, it takes... I don't think we see Venus until... I mean, obviously they go to explore it, but... Yeah, it definitely takes a back seat for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and seeing the scientist man, like, wine and dine Christian, I was like, you probably still want to go on this trip, but I'm also thinking, like, this is not going to end well for you. Or at least, I mean, I'm reading it as not well. Maybe he's like, this is the ultimate scientific discovery. But I do remember liking that character. And also, especially seeing his introduction again on this rewatch, I am disappointed he doesn't get more narrative space moving forward. But there's a lot going on in the show. I mean, he's not like the character that I'm like, if I could give more time to anyone, I would choose this guy. But he is someone that... I think when he was introduced, I thought he was going to have more to do, and he is very much a supporting character, or like there to move the plot forward in some way.
Yes, unfortunately, there's not more of him, and there's a little bit of back and forth. This is me remembering from 2 years ago, but there's a little bit of back and forth with the scientists on that ship, but not a lot before they get disintegrated or whatever, which is too bad. Also, this made me think of Kim Stanley Robinson's, I can't remember the name of the book, but it's basically set in the 2300, it's set around the same time as The Expanse, and it's sort of this mystery going 2360 something, I can't remember.
It's the date, it's whatever the date is.
Yeah.
2132
maybe? There's colonies in Venus, and there's colonies on Mercury, and the colony on Mercury is basically just a big train that keeps like chasing the dark side, which... It seems like a pointless exercise. It's just there because you can do it in a book. Like, why would you even live on Mercury? But I was like kind of expecting if you're going to live on the belt, why wouldn't you set up like some sort of a, you know, Bespin kind of a deal on Venus already? It's dumb to go, I invented this thing in my head and now you should have it in the show. But I did do that, so.
So there's this little hint in the discussion between Christian and the scientist, whose name I'm not even... I probably will learn.
I can't remember either.
I did put in the synopses.
Yeah.
But it's kind of hinted that he and Christian might have some sort of, like, romantic past, which I don't even necessarily want to talk about, but I did want to use as a segue to mention that this is the last time we see Christian's husband, or up until, you know, the end of season three. We maybe will see him in season four. I don't know. How do you guys feel about that? You wonder what Arjun is up to?
He's fun when he's on screen, but meh, you know?
Yeah, he very much feels like the, like, movie girlfriend, like the, he's convenient when he's convenient,
kind yeah. of.
But then, you know, I never was like, oh, I wish Christian would call her husband in the way that, I can't remember what Elizabeth Mitchell's character's name is, who's constantly calling her wife, being like, sorry, I'm
gonna keep right. going to that's later. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like I never am like, oh, wow, I really wish Christian was checking in. But well, if she's checking affected in. By, yeah.
If she's checking in, she's not yeah. being crafty and manipulating people, which is what I'm here for with Christian. So, and exactly. swearing. She's probably so not swearing either.
Like on, oh, yes. She's still always on the run for so much of mm-hmm. like later seasons, getting shot at or trying to. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty great that I think we've talked about this before previously on the podcast, but it's awesome that it's a part of her character, which I think is helpful to know that she has people she cares about mm-hmm. and who care about her. She has a family. But the fact that she's a grandmother, a wife, like those are not as important roles as like the fact that she's this, you know, fierce political force
mm-hmm.
and yeah, just like political genius who has devoted her life to Earth. And I had forgotten completely the detail that when most of the other like high level political figures had chosen to evacuate when Eros is coming towards Earth, she stays, which is really beautiful and cool and brave and, yeah, says so much about her character. And she's just so casual about it as well.
Yeah. Am I the only one who thinks that Eros coming towards Earth and not hitting it is kind of a bigger deal than the show makes it out to be? Like, a chunk of the asteroid belt moved into Venus, and then they're just kind of like, meh, that happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I guess this is the downside to not having this be a season finale. That yeah, at suppose, least yeah. if it were a season finale, you could also have... I think there is... Oh, no, there isn't really a time jump between these two episodes.
Yeah.
In the way that I think there might have been. If not actually, then like at least in real time, like we would have had a time jump of waiting during the hiatus.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have felt maybe like less of a big deal. But watching these two back to back in the middle of a season, you're like... Okay, and it also just goes to show, we've talked about this before as well, like, we really don't see a lot of Earth in this show, like, what it's like to live on Earth until
not yet anyway, yeah.
later. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even when we do get to see it, it's still pretty minimal. It's like, the characters who exist in, like, the political sphere, like, going for a smoke break.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of the homeless sort of downtrodden side of it, but only because yeah, Bobby's there yeah. for us to see it. Weirdly, we're seeing Earth through the eyes of a Martian, which makes it more relatable. So, okay. Mm-hmm. It works, but...
Well, it's like both from the idea of a whole asteroid moving into a planet is wild, but also like when you're having a lottery... to evacuate potentially part of Earth and mm-hmm. all your leaders are leaving, how does that affect the politics of the planet going forward?
Yeah, no kidding.
It doesn't seem like it does.
Because it seems like kind of a cowardly well. Move, yeah. No, everybody's yeah. just fine with that. It's a...
like...
But then they do mention previously that most of Earth, like the Martian propaganda is that Earthers are all just strung out on free drugs and bad TV.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they don't notice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the Martian propaganda's right.
Yeah, maybe we just aren't worth it. Maybe we should be nuked.
Yeah, they just have a follow-up news report being like, oh, that was, what, no, that wasn't a big deal. Don't worry about it.
I mean, there are parallels now to that. Yeah. I'm not too happy about, but there are.
Yeah.
I feel like we can't end the discussion on this note.
No, sorry about that.
I would say, like, there's so much of this episode, you know, with Christian is like, man, she's an incredible actor. Mm-hmm. And, like, both the, you know, her freaking out at Aaron Wright, rightfully so, you know. She's not really freaking. She's, like, showing him really, like, that her anger is just amazing. But then to also have this conversation with her husband, like, I was tearing up. I don't think I teared up the first time I saw this episode, but it's just, yeah, it's really, it's touching. And I think it's down to the two of them just... Even just with the time delay of like, oh, we're trying to, he's like, let me finish. And she doesn't even come close to letting him finish what he wants to say, which you get the sense that that's like they're a huge part of their relationship. He's mm-hmm. used to having her do that. And he still loves her just, you know, having done all of these things that she's done over the years of like, well, you've almost died so many times to save. This is clearly the biggest one, I think. Oh, saving also, them from... Yeah.
Can I just say I love her voice so much. It sounds like she swallowed a carton of cigarettes. It's fantastic.
I know.
It makes her that much cooler.
Yeah. It's.
I need to watch other things she's done. She's an incredible actress. And it is... I don't know. I do think... You know, we talked before about... having more older characters on this show in some ways than a lot of other things, a lot of other series. And just like, obviously, the older you are, the more time you've had to learn and perfect your craft.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the show makes the best of that when it comes to its casting. Just finding these incredible actors who are maybe further along in their careers or at least have like decades of experience to bring to these roles. And it's, yeah, it really elevates what is already great material.
I think sci-fi is better at that than most things too. Like, I mean, other than mm-hmm. teen CW stuff, and even then you've got older character actors as the parents. Generally, sci-fi and genre stuff is better at bringing in older actors. I'm not sure why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. I'm gonna think about that.
Yeah, because you think of something like, I mean, I know we talk about Battlestar Galactica all the time, but that's another show that gave...
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like, you know, I mean, obviously, like, someone like Edward James almost had, like, a huge career for many... Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking of the guy that plays...
Colonel Ty.
Ty. Yeah. Like, I'm sure he had a long career.
Canadian icon, my friends. And let's not forget the doctor, like, Donnelly Rhodes.
Oh, yeah. Like, there are so many great...
And Mary McConnell.
Actors. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just like, oh, wow. Just go rewatch Battlestar.
Yeah, it's just it's a resource that's like, should be tapped into more.
Yeah.
I wonder how much that's Canadian, too. Like, there's a lot of Canadian actors in these Canadian film shows, and so they're just available. Like.
Yeah.
Because this is made in Toronto. Battlestar was made in Vancouver. There's other ones, too. So I wonder how much of that is. There's just that many older actors who are applying their trade in that town. But then that would be, well, maybe it wouldn't be. If you're in LA, you the currency is being young, right? So,
yeah.
So maybe that's part of it. Film somewhere else and you get different stuff.
Yeah, I mean, these towns, like these Canadian cities have really built up an infrastructure. And this is like around the film industry. And this is one resource they have to bring.
But even New York has got the theater scene to draw from. And that skews generally older too, right? So, I mean, and you show see shows from New York, it's usually older character actors. So maybe that's, just L.A. that's the problem is what I'm saying.
Let's blame LA.
There's no old people in L.A.
Nope. They've been banned.
So moving forward, are there storylines that you're particularly excited to see play out again or scenes or moments you're looking forward to in any of these storylines that we talked about tonight?
Now that you mentioned that priest and her wife, like I'd totally forgotten about that. Now I want to see it again.
I was like, actually, the stretch of episodes coming up on Ganymede, I really remember liking.
Mm-hmm.
Just, yeah. Once the Rossi gets to Ganymede, which takes a little while, I think. I can't remember how long it takes them to get there.
It takes a while. And then Botanist guy shows up, and he's one of my favorite characters, so.
Oh, I love him. I mean, as a farmer, I'm...
Well, yeah.
Of course, I like the plant guy, but, yeah. And I also, I like that actor from a few other things, so whenever he shows up, I'm... Yeah,
He's great. I'm excited to get to the Bobby Christian stuff, which I was already excited to get to. But even more than the Bobby Christian stuff, like, the Bobby stuff. I love, like, watching her go through this, like, terrifying, traumatic experience. I want her to figure it out for, like, for herself even more this time. Because last time I was like, I want her to figure it out for me because I don't know what's going on. But, like, seeing her go through the process of making sense of what happens on Ganymede and also how she fits into this larger, like, geopolitical structure is so rewarding, and I can't wait to watch it again.
She has the biggest arc by far, I think, of anybody, right? So.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we were talking about older actors, but, like, Frankie Adams had done, like, a New Zealand soap before this.
Mm-hmm.
And she just gets so much to do, and she just really knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
And I hope she's in series four. Yeah, and getting to
see... Yeah, yeah.
I believe she will be. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss episodes 7 and 8 of season 2, The Seventh Man, Empire. Until then, I vouch for James Holden.